get your party hat on, have a very small glass of sweet sherry, and get ready for a telegram from the Queen, because this is our 100th show. Who would have thought in 2016 that we'd still be rummaging through the steaming entrails of pop for auguries 2 years later? Well, here we are. I'm Andrew Harrison, and my co-host for the affair, as ever, is Sean Pattenden, the sophisticated Renee to my overblown Renato. Hello, Sean, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Andrew.
Jolly good. Happy birthday to us.
Yay!
Well done, yeah. Us. Party hats all around.
Absolutely.
You're going to get drunk and tell everybody what you really think of them.
Well, I already have.
Okay.
Yeah, so the room is fairly clear, isn't it? Yeah.
Fair dues. Because it's a special occasion, we have special guests with us this week. Simon Day is the artist formerly known as Tommy Cockles, and also as Eco Warrior Dave Angel, Inspector Monkfish, and Competitive Dad from The Fast Show. Also Billy Bleach from Grass, and of course, Brian Pern. Much missed, he's with the band In Heaven now, jamming with Prince and Peter Sarsted. Simon has been back on the boards, touring his roster of characters in stand-up format across the country. Later this year, he's touring a doubleheader with John Cooper Clarke. Hello, Simon.
Hello.
How are you doing? Welcome to Big Mouth.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to have me on.
I didn't see the stage show, but Brian Pern is back from the dead. I understand.
Yes, he's back from the dead. We do a bit of Brian at the end.
How did you pull that off?
He never really did die. It was a tax dodge, wasn't it?
Oh, right, okay. So he hadn't been on Rock Death Island with Elvis and
Richie Manning. When I do it live, I say, yeah, I was forced into a tax dodge by my manager, John Farrow. He was going to be here tonight, but he does Fool's War, so he doesn't need the money. And that's probably the biggest laugh of the night. And they stare at me with my sort of slightly dusty wig.
Were you surprised at how widely people got Brian Pern? Because it's very sort of inside rock joke for the likes of us, isn't it? And it seems to like speak to everybody.
I would disagree. I would say it's just an inside rock joke. I have not met anybody that like it. I mean, I'm sure people do like it who see it, but it's BBC4. You're sort of hampered by the lack of viewers, but I'm very happy with what people thought of it.
But it was very much like headlining the other stage at Glastonbury.
Yeah,
it's like the biggest thing on a smaller stage.
I think if they put it on a different channel and repeated it, it might do well, but it was a niche show. You know, it was made to go on BBC4.
Yeah. Peter Gabriel quite liked it, didn't he? He appeared in it towards the end as well.
Well, as Eric Clapton said, he had to like it.
Do you think did you talk to him about it, like sort of, you know, over a sandwich in the green room kind of thing?
I think people probably said to him, oh, this show's really funny, and he would have looked really curmudgeonly if he said, I don't get it, or no, that's not me, or do you know what I mean? And it was very affectionate, and it wasn't, there was nothing obscene in it, or we didn't have a go at him in it.
Yeah.
It was just about we just exaggerated his whole sort of English reserve and the fact he didn't take drugs. And you have a rock star on telly, they're always got leather jacket and they smoke and they throw things out a window. So we wanted to do someone who would never do that.
How come you didn't go the full Spinal Tap and actually record a Thatch album for proper release?
We recorded some songs.
You should have put them out, though.
They're on iTunes.
You could have done a Neil's Heavy concept album with them and like had an actual
Oh, yeah, maybe we will.
So who are the characters in the character show? Because it's Simon Day in character, isn't it?
It is Billy Bleach, the pub bore from The Fast Show, Geoffrey Allerton, Yorkshire's finest unpublished poet, Tony Beckton, Britain's Most Dangerous Man, 24 Years Inside, and Brian Pern. And I'm playing at the 10th, 11th and 12th at the Jackson's Lane Community Centre. Is that right?
That's in London?
Yeah. Yes.
That is.
Highgate.
It's right by the Highgate Tube.
Yes, by Highgate Tube.
You keep seeing Competitive Dad and Billy Bleach around in the real world.
Yes.
Do you think, are we generating new, they're kind of timeless characters, aren't they? Are we generating new ones as Britain warps and changes and becomes weirder and nastier?
I mean, I now have a son who plays football and he's just had a trial for Orient and he's quite good. And you do see other dads staring at me, looking like they're going mad, thinking that's that bloke who did that on telly. And now he's doing it to his own son in real life. And I've met a few dads who say, yeah, oh, I used to shout at my son, I'll stop now. But they're talking about like alcoholism or something. They go, oh, I used to really shout at him, I've stopped now, but you know, I used to be terrible. I think the ones who played the game, I'm just very happy to have him there because I was never any good. But I think there's dads there who were really good and they're trying to get across to a little, you know, if their son's prepared to go the extra 5 yards, they could do really well. But of course, I think most kids are quite intelligent and they realise that they just want to have a bit of fun and they don't really want to be in a very high, intense environment.
So does your presence stop Competitive Dads being quite so horrible? Should we put cardboard copies of you around football pitches like the cardboard policemen that stop you speeding?
Maybe. I've heard terrible things. I've not seen any. I've seen some coaches shouting some crazy stuff, but no dad's doing anything really bad.
That's because you're there making them not want to do it.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe I'm the policeman. Scarecrow.
Yes. Also with us, we have one of the first guests from the very first Big Mouth, back when it was etched on an Edison cylinder and featured reviews of Marie Lloyd at the Hackney Empire, the all-new Ragtime 78s, and a film of a train accelerating towards a terrified cinema audience. It's Andrew Collins, film editor at the Radio Times, former Enemy, Q and Select Man, and, by strange coincidence, writer of the sitcom Grass featuring Simon Day. Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Very well. It's in the same place as the first.
It is in the same place.
Big Mouth, which is nice to know. You haven't moved into Palatial Studios.
You're even in the same seat.
Yeah.
It's like the past 2 years never
happened. Always in the same seat. You also write comedy for TV and radio, present Saturday Night at the Movies on Classic FM, and you're a recovering goth, Andrew, who's now 9 years free, apparently, of wearing Cure T-shirts and those baggy Fields of Nephilim shorts, which are now difficult to find in shops.
Sure. I did have some long, baggy indie shorts, which
did
I kept
they have
for a long time. Yeah,
there
was pockets, and they were actually L7. They had
such
an L7 logo.
Band. Sorry, Andrew. That's such a good goth band name, isn't it? You're really setting out your stall with that name.
So, long shorts are long gone now.
Okay, and you're a TV aficionado. What three?
Who
film...
isn't?
Yeah, they're all experts these days.
You'd be bloody surprised.
You're an official one, aren't you?
Yes.
Radio Times and all. Yeah. Three films or telly things we should be watching this week. Tell us.
That's what Alison Graham does in Radio Times. She gets to do that. Three things you have to watch this week.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I would say that if you're watching television and you haven't yet, if you have Amazon Prime, if you haven't yet watched The Looming Tower, it's absolutely superb. It's a dramatised version of real life leading up to September the 11th and how the FBI and the CIA basically blew it by not communicating with each other. Superb, based on the book The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright. That's good. You've got to watch that.
Okay.
If you've got Netflix, which some people have, you also need to watch 7 Seconds, which is a kind of a sort of police procedural with a bit of... corruption thrown in, and that's set in Jersey, where you can see the Statue of Liberty in the background the whole time, and it's kind of symbolic.
It kind of moves around the Statue of Liberty, doesn't it? Because it's in every single shot in a film made in Jersey. It must be on wheels or a little hovercraft.
Yeah, or it could be drawn on afterwards. I hate to ruin it for you.
Yes.
So that's good. Also, what is good on...
The assassination of Gianni Versace.
Yes, I was going to bring that up later, though.
God, sorry.
Yeah. It is brilliant, you're right.
It's
absolutely amazing. Yeah.
Okay.
So there you go. That's three dramas on three different platforms.
Yes. So you've been bringing up Below the Surface from BBC Four, another platform. What's that then?
I like Below the Surface. I thought Nordic Noir was not dead, but just kind of coasting a bit, because I haven't watched. I've actually let a few go by, and I used to never miss anything from Scandinavia. And then I started to watch this one. It's a hostage drama. It's just finished on BBC Four. It's out on DVD now. And it's actually really, really gripping. And it's one of those where there's lots of people thrown together by this unfortunate thing. They're underground. There's these nasty terrorists.
Nasty terrorists?
Yeah.
They're the worst kind.
They're nasty because you don't know who they are. And they just call each other by code names. And so there's that
mystery. Dead lady count? Well, high or low?
There's actually... Yeah, there's. If I say there's one,
there's one dead lady
in it, but it's not about her.
If only the Word magazine was still going, we could review it and headline it "The Mighty Noir." Could be an exclamation mark at the end.
So that is good.
Splendid.
Okay, so on the show this week we've got the return of Urban Myths on Sky, the serio-comic reimagining of various obscure events from pop culture history as if they really did happen. What did David Bowie and Mark Bolan say to each other when they met for the first time? What really went on backstage at Live Aid? And is it all that funny? Plus, Chaz and Dave, yay, have a new album out, which I'm really quite excited about. Oh, shush. The first with new songs on it for 30 years. What do we think? And how much better is it than the Libertines? Sticking on the roll out the barrel theme, we'll be looking at the reissue of legendary First World War comic Charlie's War. It's been described as the monocled mutineer for kids. How does it stand up 100 years after the end of the war that... didn't actually end all wars? And Juliana Hatfield has done an album of Olivia Newton-John covers. Why, oh, why, oh, why, and what's it like? All this and more after this brief message.
It is our 100th show, so why not send us a small gift to help us cover our studio and recording expenses? If you buy us a notional non-physical pint once a month via the crowdfunding platform Patreon, it'll help us pay our bills and keep the show going. A mere fiver a month from 120 listeners will cover all our studio costs, and we are very much nearing our target of £600 a month. Once the Blue Peter totaliser gets there, we're going to start doing extra bits each week just for our lovely Patreon backers. So go to patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. The link is at the top of the Big Mouth Facebook page. All we are saying is buy us a pint. Okay, let's get started with Urban Myths on Sky, in which a rotating cast of writers and actors recreate, and sometimes reinvent, lost moments from the history of entertainment. The new second series gives us the first meeting between future frenemies Mark Bolan and David Bowie, a Public Enemy fan in Sheffield giving the band an emergency lift to their gig in his Ford Focus, and the Sex Pistols versus Bill Grundy. What did we make of it? We're going to find out after a bit of Public Enemy. This is Bring the Noise. Never bad and bad, because a brother is madder than mad at the fact that's corrupt like a senator. Soul on the road, but you treat it like soap on the rope, because the beats and the lines are so dope. Listen for lessons I'm saying inside music that the critics are all blasting me for. They'll never care for the brothers and sisters. Why, because the country has us up for the war. We got to get them straight. Come on now, they're going to have to wait till we get it right. Radio stations are questioning blackness. They call us a black, but we'll see if they'll play this. Public Enemy with Bring the Noise. An episode of their hectic post-fame life appears in the new series of Urban Myths on Sky. I thought the Public Enemy one was the best one. Andrew Collins, TV person, what did you make of the new series and bits that you saw of it?
Well, I think I watched nearly all of the first series, which did really well for Sky Arts, which is a little offshoot of the larger Sky channels. Mm-hmm. They got 600,000 viewers, which for them is a huge amount. And so if it drove people to the arts, then that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But They're questionable because some are good and some aren't. They're all half an hour long. Some of them are genuinely based on urban myths. Some of them are a little bit less strong than that. But in the first series, the most famous thing about the first series is that it had one about Elizabeth Taylor, Michael Jackson and Marlon Brando being in a car driving away from September the 11th because they couldn't get out of New York any other way.
Yeah.
And that this apparently never happened, but it's a myth. But Joseph Fiennes, the white person, was playing Michael Jackson. And then you can see little clips of it in it. Mm-hmm. I think on YouTube there's a trailer for it. And the Jackson family said, I don't think so. And so they never showed it. So that's what this series became, more of a kind of cause célèbre.
I find it odd that the Jackson family gets a veto. That's like when you weren't allowed to put Princess Diana on Spitting Image because apparently it was against medieval law or something.
I think they just stamped their feet and said, this is not right. And in fact, I think it was Michael Jackson's daughter who was most cross. So they just felt really embarrassed and decided not to ever run it. So that's why the first series was shorter than the second. There's a lot of different writers, some acquaintances of ours, like Dave Cummings. Neil Forsyth is a very good writer. Mm. He's done at least one in this one, if not two. He did the Live Aid one. And they are, for a writer, a little gift. Mm. You get to write something that's not even half an hour long about something you want to do, and they'll go and find a lot of people, and really famous people, to appear in tiny parts.
Yeah.
It's incredible, the high quality of the casts, but I suppose they just think this will be fun.
It is a high quality generally, but it's quite variable. I thought the Public Enemy one was fantastic. The Live Aid one, less so. It was more kind of a string of sketches, I thought. Simon, which ones did you see, and what did you...
I saw the Live Aid one, and I saw a bit of the Frank Skinner one and turned it off very quickly. Which is a little bit shocking, seeing Frank Skinner playing Johnny Cash, but I had to see it.
Yeah.
This is the sort of thing that I would probably complain to my agent of not being approached about, so I feel high down to criticise it.
This is really good.
The one thing I found a problem with Live Aid, having met a lot of those people through doing Pern, that Sade came across as being a bit sort of sarky, and she is the nicest person in the world.
Yeah.
And I know this because I once did a gig, a corporate gig for a record company boss, and in Bamington House, and I was hidden away, and I was doing this 20 minutes, and he had all the people, 60 people. He had Echo 100 were there, the Mannix, Sade, Depeche Mode. Basically, he went on and on talking. I was about to go on. I was waiting to go on, and then he suddenly played a film for 45 minutes.
Right.
And I was still waiting to go on, and because they're all watching the film. Then he introduced everyone, you know, bit by bit, and then it came to me, and because the minute I came on, everyone was desperate for the loo, but they couldn't go whilst he was showing the film and talking. So I came on stage, and suddenly the whole of 80s pops stood up in front of me, apart from Sade, who sat right at the front.
Oh,
came up and said, that was amazing, that was brilliant, because she's a South East London girl, so she's got it.
So she's lovely, she's friendly, and she's got a strong bladder.
Yes.
Clearly, you really hold it in. Well,
that's
done,
what
Sade.
I was thinking when I spoke to her. But no, they're a mixed bag, and they're supposed to be a bit of fun, aren't they?
Yeah.
The Sex Pistols one is odd because that is such a well-known sequence of television.
Yes.
And Kevin Eldon did a version of it on his sketch show a few years back, where all of the people who are the Sex Pistols and their entourage are replaced by Amish people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they speak in exactly the same voices and absolutely note perfect impressions by everybody. That was kind of clever because it was weird.
Yes,
whereas this is just basically a retelling of something that we all know very well. And the stuff backstage is funny, but you just want to see how accurate it can be, and then that's not what television's there for, is
the
it?
The one I enjoyed most, like I say, was the Public Enemy one, because it's a real story, it really happened, but there is a story to this story, there's an arc. Yeah. Public Enemy can't get to the gig. Who's going to get into the gig? A divorced bloke called Kev, who is not getting on with his angry missus, who doesn't believe that he's late because I've got to get Public Enemy to the gig in my Ford Focus. And also, it seemed to be written with deep knowledge, because there's a lot of actual Public Enemy quotes in there.
Yes.
You get pulled over by the police, and Flavor says, "I've got a right to be hostile, my people being persecuted." That's actually off of Public Enemy record.
Yeah, yeah.
And Patterson Joseph is fantastic as this really worn-down, world-weary
Chuck D.
Does Flavor really call him Chucky D in real life?
It's wonderful. Everyone calls him Chucky D by the end of the programme as well.
Chucky D.
So I thought that, and I thought I'd happily watch a six-part sitcom of Life in Public Enemy, like Slade in Residence.
Yeah, I'd rather see one which is an actual story, like you say. Like the Frank Skinner one was actually a good idea. It was about a funny little bit of Johnny Cash's life when he was in England.
Mm.
And I was thinking Bobby Moore went and played football for a Swedish second division club towards the end of his career. I always thought that'd be a good idea, but nothing to do with this, and I shouldn't really have brought it up.
Well, they might commission it now. Series three.
Well, the best one
in the first series was Eddie Marzan as Bob Dylan, who famously, mythically, turned up in Crouch End in North London to visit Dave Stewart's studio.
Yeah.
And couldn't find it, and knocked on the door and was standing at the front door, as Bob Dylan would have looked at the time, and just said, "Is Dave there?" And it happened to be the house of someone who had a Dave living there who wasn't there. And his wife said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, can I come in and see? He's not there." Well, you can come in and wait for him if you like. So Bob Dylan went in and sat apparently in the front room watching telly,
waiting for Dave,
talking to Mrs. Dave.
And Dave was a plasterer or something.
Yeah, he just came back and she said, "Oh, your friend Bob's here."
Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Bob Dylan.
This is commemorated in a mural in Crouch End, which has got a little picture of Bob Dylan saying, "Is Dave around?"
I would imagine that somewhere down the line, the original meeting at the production company would have been that story. They're going, "There must be another six of those," and then they said, "Well, now we've got another six. Maybe there's not another six."
Yeah. Sean, what did you think?
I felt it was a little bit of a parade of wigs. the problem is, as Andrew said, is someone doing a good impression of someone else? Is David Bowie looking like David Bowie? Is Mark Bolan Jack Whitehall?
Yeah.
Is that good enough as an impression rather than what's actually happening in the story? And what's happening in the story is Mark Bolan in that one and David Bowie are bitching at each other and painting a wall.
Yeah.
And there's only so far you can go with that narrative. Yeah.
It's kind of lacking in the ticking clock, isn't it, really?
Exactly. We don't have the literal journey, which we do have with the car in there. There's a wonderful line. Steve Oram plays this. Well, I think Steve Oram should have been Kev Wells, but that's my... Because I think Steve Oram is so funny. He plays this beleaguered taxi driver, and there's one point where Chuck D rings again and says, "Look, we really need a taxi." And he says, "Yeah, we've got a driver, but he's been delayed picking up NWA and dropping them off at Vanilla Ice's house." And that just made me laugh and laugh and laugh. So there were real nuggets there, but then you get these flops like Bolan. I mean, I saw the Sex Pistols one again. It was, "Look at some wigs."
Yeah.
We know the dialogue, but there's some people in wigs.
It was a bit like, "Oh, let's ring up Jack and say, who would you like to play?" There was a bit of that.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, Noel Fielding would love to play someone.
But he couldn't master the American accent. I think Noel Fielding is doing very well in his career, so he doesn't need our help. But at the same time, he can't do an American accent. So the whole Alice Cooper one was kind of slightly undermined.
Yeah.
Even though he played him probably in his own mind exactly as Alice Cooper would be, he sounded like Noel Fielding. And that was unfortunate.
Well, our past guest, David Hepworth, actually was at Live Aid, as listeners will know. And here is his recollection of what went on there. So, David Hepworth, you saw the urban myths about Live Aid, at which you personally were present. Or did it ring true?
Well, everybody's experience of these things is slightly different. You know, I spent most of my time in a Perspex box suspended from under the eaves of the old Wembley Stadium, the same Perspex box from which Des Lynam used to preside over, you know, England friendlies. So I didn't see anything that looked like what we saw in the programme, which is, it's kind of like a sort of wish fulfillment fantasy for somebody who read smash hits probably back in the 80s, you know, and has constructed this idea of how pop stars at Live Aid would have reacted and all their kind of minor jealousies over the running order and mid-year feeling that his Ultravox have not been as advantageously placed as Bob Geldof's Boomtown Rats and so forth, you know, which I think is rather imposing something on it that didn't actually happen at the time, because You know, I don't think Boomtown Rats ended up selling any records as a consequence of Live Aid at all, you know.
David Hepworth there, who really was at Live Aid. Okay, let's go back to now. We always ask our guests to bring in a tune for the listeners. Simon Day, what have you brought in for us, please?
I've brought in a song. One of my favourite songs is Moon River, Frank Sinatra being the track that I like best, the version. And the other day I suddenly heard Frank Ocean, a singer who I'm very keen on, doing a cover version of it. And I thought, well, that'd be good. And it was really quite odd and a little bit pretentious, which is nothing wrong with that. What I liked about it, he had a girl singing at the beginning and then she never appears in the record again. It was like he sort of cut her out of the whole mix. But it's interesting anyway. It's very odd, but I quite liked it. He's an artist who I'm all for because he pushes boundaries, although I don't like that phrase.
And when would you listen to this?
In the bath, probably. Yeah.
Okay, good. We need that info, you see.
We do.
Yeah, don't imagine me in the bath, ladies and gentlemen. I've got one of those boards you put over with the little thing my head comes out, like in James Bond film when he turns the dial and overheats.
One of those little boards you can have your cheese on toast right in the bath.
Yeah, I've been reading James Bond books again, so I'm a bit James Bonded out.
Well, let's have a listen to this. You can retire your Morrissey version of Moon River. You can listen to Frank Ocean's instead. By Frank Ocean, as chosen by our guest Simon Day. And what could be better to follow that than the chirpy cockney sound of duo Chaz and Dave? A Little Bit of Us is on their old Rockney label through Cooking Vinyl, and it's a mix of covers and new tunes with added poignancy given Chaz Hodges' survival from cancer and the death of Dave Peacock's wife in 2009. They split up around that, but they've got back together again, possibly because Chaz and Dave is what they do, and it is who they are. There was a time when snooty rock critics like me thought Chaz and Dave were a bit of a joke. Were we wrong? We're going to discuss it after this track. This is Wonder Where He Is Now.
Wonder where he is now, my old pal. Me and him used to go fishing in the old canal. I woke this morning thinking about him. Don't know why, don't know. I wonder what he's doing off. I should like to know.
Wonder Where He Is Now by Chaz and Dave from A Little Bit of Us. Now, Simon Day, you're a Blackheath lad. This is your wheelhouse. What did you think? Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I think it's great. And I really like Chaz and Dave, and I really love their... Ain't No Pleasing You was just such a great song. Obviously the other stuff, Rabbit and so forth, they were a bit of a joke. But you know, if they were American, I think they would be sort of canonised a lot more than they are here. And they are in that sort of funny area of sort of fighting between songs and stuff like that, which they would admit to, you know. But they're very distinctive, you know. I would sort of bracket them more towards the sort of Small Faces and...
Well, definitely, that song there, Wonder Where He Is Now, that's like, that could be the Kinks, that could be Squeeze.
Exactly.
It's really quite poignant and heartbreaking, I thought.
They're the only sort of people who play that sort of music, really. And it's kind of like music for pearly kings in a way, isn't it? But it's very sad and it really comes across. They really know how to deliver write a sad song and deliver it.
You don't hear a song about fishing in a canal much.
Not very often.
No, they genuinely don't.
I don't think the word Gurnard has appeared in pop music before. Possibly. Bernard the Gurnard, there's a song once writing. Simon, do you think Dave Angel would dig him? Make a
love him.
Eco album about looking after the little fishies?
Absolutely adore him, yeah.
Yeah, you've got to save Romney Marshes with the sound of Chaz.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, it's definitely kind of... And I remember... You know, because I was a pretentious little snot in the 80s thinking, what's this cockney rubbish?
Yeah.
But actually, it is the sound of a lost world. And a good sort of half of this album is covers of the kind of songs your granddad would have sung. It's got brilliant backing.
I mean, when I was in Argentina, we did this program in Argentina, and the guy there played this, he played a sort of an Argentinian sort of folk song. It's really emotional. And I said, you know, he was asking us what our stuff is. And I was sort of saying to him, that sort of London pride is sort of all tied up with the National Front, isn't it? That sort of music and really in London, eels and pies and London cobblestones is tied up with sort of football hooliganism and sort of fascism. Not fascism, you know.
They've pinched it.
Yeah, and it's a shame, really, because it's. I'm sure they are very proud to be, you know, and they would probably love to go and get the OBEs and all that. Let's start a campaign.
Yeah, Chaz OBE and Dave OBE.
There's no reason why not.
What did you think of this record?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of them, a very small amount of them, because it is mostly cover versions. But at the same time, the worst songs on it are theirs, I think, in this case. I mean, I have nothing against them at all. They're good fun. Yeah. And also, when they first decided we're going to sing in Cockney, in our Cockney dialect, instead of singing American, which is what everybody else is doing at the time.
Yeah.
You know, Chaz was a side man playing with Jerry Lee Lewis and people like that. You know, so he was in the thick of kind of Tin Pan Alley. And they thought, well, we're not going to be American. We're going to be London. And so I think it's quite radical what they were doing. It just became because there's a sort of a kind of carnival circus element to them, a novelty element to them, that they've not been taken seriously as musicians. They obviously are good musicians, but there's a piano version of the Roses of Picardy, which is a kind of World War One trenches song, which is really rather lovely. Yeah. As a piece of piano, and it sounds like the piano in a track on Low by David Bowie, in a kind of clanky kind of pub piano sound. And so there's loads of roots back into what is notionally cool music from this. So there's plenty in it, and I really liked it. I must admit, I was surprised, but I was more interested in the cover versions. The fact that there are new songs by them on is less interesting to me than the fact they're doing Nagasaki from the jazz age, stuff like that, and Dem Bones, Dem Dry Bones, which is a spiritual. So I think actually their choice of material is very good.
Yeah. Sean, did you enjoy it?
I surprisingly did. I didn't imagine I was going to like it at all. I thought, you know, now I'm the granddad, isn't it?
Yeah.
Shove that on. There's a real warmth to it. It's really beautifully produced, I thought. Mm. There's a lot of brass on there, and brass can sound really nasty and harsh.
Yeah.
That warmth and that there's a quite live feel, there's lots of the pianos live, so there's drum sound. She thought the person who produced it's a genius as well. There's something about it, and it reminded me, yes, of my dad. And I come from Twickenham, where there are lots of bits of river where people just sit all day
fishing,
not getting anything. And something about that world compared with a bit, oh, let's tweet out some stuff to North Korea and everybody hates each other and something about that sentimentality it's quite warm to, and I thought how lovely, and by the end I wanted to marry both Chaz and Dave.
We're
in a sort
quick.
Of weird wedding and two of them might not be legal, but because it was just like these are two nice blokes, you know. I really sort of felt for them. I felt for that whole era and growing up, and just, you know, those are the two dads you want, aren't they? Really?
They're like a married couple, aren't they? Because they can't not be together.
What I quite like is that the album starts with a tune that is basically a rejoinder to their past tune. It's the anti-rabbit. It's the opposite of saying, shut up, there's no ain't no pleas in you. The opening track is like, we are two halves of the same thing. Mm. We can't do without each other. Yeah. You know, and obviously, there's many dimensions to this because it's Chaz and Dave, but it's also, you know, Dave's late wife and all that kind of thing. It's really good. It's, it's a concept album.
That would be a good urban myth. Chaz going off and doing a difficult solo album with top American jazz funk session musicians.
Yes. Well, apparently, there was an urban myth at Q Magazine, Collins. You may remember this, that somebody had seen a sign saying, tonight, Chaz and Dave, not original Dave. So it's kind of Chaz and, you know. But I think these are unworthy gags about Chaz and Dave, because this is a music institution and we ought to celebrate them.
Yeah. So we pitched two urban myth episodes for that.
There you go, absolutely.
Now.
Yeah. I mean, and also these are songs that had to work in pubs full of rowdy shouting people. Yeah. So that's like, you can't get away with your 8 minute sort of, you know, sample.
It's like watching the documentary about Sleaford Mods. You know, it's just basically a bloke with a laptop and on a beer crate and another bloke shouting. But there's some brilliant footage of their earlier gigs before they just suddenly went overground.
Yeah.
And they're just in noisy pubs.
Yeah.
And there are about three people standing in the front actually taking notice, and the rest are just making noise. Yeah. So basically, Sleaford Mods are a kind of
Chaz and Dave. That's good.
East Midlands Chaz and Dave.
Chaz and Dave did to an extent partly invent park life, and unfortunately, they partly invented the Libertines as well. They also did partly invent Chaz and Dave, do we think?
Lily Allen?
Brexit.
Go there?
They did probably invented Brexit.
I don't know.
Hold that against them. Yeah, a little bit of politics there. Well, I really like this record, not least 33 minutes long, brief and to the point. That's what we want.
Yeah. Get in and get out.
Absolutely.
Get out.
Let's have a bit more music. Andrew Collins, what track would you like to play and why?
Well, something completely different to Frank Ocean, I think, because I thought that would be a good balance. Mm-hmm. I hosting my show on Saturday on Classic FM is where we play 2 hours of film soundtracks every week, which I'm allowed to choose with my producer, which is a joy. I've been doing it for nearly three years now. And only on last week's show, we had a whole hour of Ron Goodwin lined up, British composer, no longer with us. And he's most famous for writing 623 Squadron, Battle of Britain, Where Eagles Store, Eagles Dare, fantastic war movie teams. He's brilliant at those. And of course, the day that it would go out on Saturday was the day after bombs fell on Syria. Yeah. So we had to remove the war movies from Goodwin, the Goodwin Hour, which was a great shame. Mm. But we found lots of other stuff that he'd done, which was good. Not least, Frenzy, the last but one Alfred Hitchcock film.
Oh,
a nasty piece of work set around Covent Garden, the Covent Garden of Alfred Hitchcock's youth. Barry Foster is strangling him with the neckties. So it's nasty, but it opens brilliantly with this fantastic theme, the London theme, and it's a helicopter shot, which must have been cost a lot of money in those days.
No drones,
or balloons. Coming down the Thames and takes us under Tower Bridge. It's absolutely a superb sequence. It's probably on YouTube in its entirety, but the music's superb.
Okay, let's have a listen. This is The London Theme by Ron Goodwin from the Hitchcock film Frenzy. The London Theme by Ron Goodwin from Hitchcock's Frenzy, as chosen by cinephile Andrew Collins. Now, sticking with the Chaz theme, this month sees the re-release of Charlie's War, the great British comic story of the First World War, first printed in Battle Action Weekly between 1979 and 1986. Written by Pat Mills, the creator of 2000 AD, and drawn by Master of British Comics Joe Colquhoun, Charlie's War is, for my money, the greatest achievement in all of British comics. But what do the panel think? To get you in the mood, here's Murray Johnson from the original days of the First World War with Pack Up Your Troubles.
Private Buck went a marching into Flanders with his smile, his sunny smile. He was loved by the privates and commanders for his smile, his sunny smile. When the throng of Germans came along with a mighty swing, Turk yelled out, "This little bunch is mine. Keep your head down, boys, and sing."
There was a lot of singing of Pack Up Your Troubles in Your Old Kit Bag there, particularly from Simon Day. That was Murray Johnson with, it can't be the original, it goes back centuries, but with an original recording of Pack Up Your Troubles to get you in the mood. Simon, were you much of a one for the war comics as a kid?
Yeah, I was. And I love that. I love British comics. I wasn't obsessed with war comics per se, but Alf Tupper, Tough of the Track was my favourite story. It was just so ludicrous. He would always turn up in fish and chips and then win the race at the last minute. But I always loved British comics and hated Marvel and Disney, and I hate those films, and as much as my kids like them, I don't really enjoy them. And you know, I think it's a really good format. You know, I was lucky enough to do a voice on the Ethel and Ernest, the Raymond Briggs film. They just got made. And I really think they should make a good British cartoon, you know, story, and spend a lot of money on it. I think that would be fantastic. I don't know if Alf Tupper would really do that well, but I'd go and see it.
Did you enjoy Charlie's War?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I just think there's the sort of level of detail in the drawing and the dialogue and stuff like that. I found it really interesting. I mean, it is a museum piece, but I liked it. But then I'm at that age where I sort of like anything that's slightly old.
Well, I mean,
is it old? Yeah, love it.
It kind of sticks pretty vividly in my memory. You're saying the artwork is incredible, and there's a whole, you know, the things in there that I've subsequently seen in the Imperial War Museum or in books where I've seen where Joe Golden has used the reference of things a London bus that's been taken over to Flanders and it's full of Tommy and it's all waiting to, you know, to go in into what they don't know what they're going into. But it's the poignancy of the story, because it's a 16-year-old lad who joins up because he thinks it's his duty, and he fakes his age and all the rest of it, and he gets thrown into this hellhole where Pat Mills does a brilliant thing, which he did in a lot of his comic stories, which is he introduces you to a vivid cast of characters who you're really going to like, and they're full of energy and they're full of, you know, full of uniqueness, and then he kills them one by one. Every Thursday the comic comes out and you lose this character that you love. And for me, there's a moment in the first volume where a particular character, who I won't name in case anybody reads it, that you've been really attached to, is killed just out of the blue. And then the following week, you see Charlie walking down a trench with a bag. And a military policeman stops and says, "You, what have you got there? Have you been stealing? What's in the bag?" Charlie says, "It's me mace. It's that's what's left of me mace." And for that, for an 8-year-old kid,
yeah.
Oh, wow.
Still just tears me up.
Yeah.
Andrew Collins, were you a reader of these things?
Yeah, I mean, my brother, my younger brother, Simon, was the one who ended up going into the army when he was 16. So he was absolutely fixated on military stuff. But we used to watch every war film that was on television.
Yeah.
And we had Warlord, I think, which came out just before Battle.
Yeah.
So Battle was a kind of riposte to Warlord. It was a little bit more working class. I think that was the idea of it. And we loved Battle. And they both had free gifts on the front cover of the first one, obviously, stickers on one and golden badges on the other. But nevertheless, we were absolutely, you know, we devoured these things. And it's interesting looking back on them. I mean, this one, because it's set in World War One, that was not the war that everybody was interested in.
Yeah.
You know, most of the films we saw on television that we loved were The Guns of Navarone and, you know...
And I think Pat Mills had to fight quite hard to get a First World War story green-lit.
Because it's not so sexy, is it?
No, it's a complicated war and no progress is made. And to this day, we're still, like, not really entirely sure what the morality of it was.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking back on it now with more kind of advanced eyes, and I'm seeing things in there that are so poignant. I mean, I would have taken them for granted at the time because I knew what World War One was, and it was in trenches. But there's a scene in it. I think Charlie's probably his first birthday since joining up. Well, it must be his 17th birthday, and they're sitting around singing Happy Birthday to him, and they've all got gas masks on. It's a really ghostly image.
Yeah.
There's another character who sees this platoon that nobody else can see.
Lonely. He's been driven mad by the war.
I'm finding more in it looking at it again now, and I'm glad that it's in an anthology format, so I don't have to wait for next week's episode to come on television. I can just keep going. So I've kind of found myself rather sort of stuck in it. I can't stop looking at it.
It's been re-released as part of the Treasury of British Comics, because the people who now own 2000 AD, it was a small independent company called Rebellion, and now buying up all the old British comics. So they're going to do the Steel Claw, Adam Eterno, the Steel Commando. All these things are all coming back. Sean's looking at me blankly. Like, what did you
try not? The little lady in the room. I used to read Beano and Whizzer and Chips, and it didn't get very warlike. And I like comics a lot, but I like those sorts of comics that weren't about wars and about people dying. My problem with this is, I know that most of the people, I'm going to be fed their story. I'm going to really get to know them in this comic, and then they're gonna die.
Yeah.
And that makes me feel really sad. I also have a son who's nearly 13. That's 3 years away from from Charlie going. And it's making it difficult, because I'm actually more drawn to the characters than I would be if I was 12 myself.
Yeah.
I find it quite difficult because it is really poignant. It's something I've never encountered before, though. The war comic didn't get to St. Stephen's.
Did you notice that Charlie is anti-chemical weapons in it as well?
Yeah.
Because when they're gassed, he says, "That's not right, you know, that's not proper, that's not..." He's aware.
And he's writing to his mum, and I think those things, writing the mum and then getting the letters back from dad and all that sort of thing, that really brings it to life, rather than if it was just all, this is me and the war. You get a glimpse of this is another life, the life that he left.
Yeah.
So I find it quite difficult to actually get through, but I'm
I'm immensely powerful stuff. But it's also, I think, very funny. There's a couple of great characters. There's Smith 70, who's in charge of the machine guns, and there's so many Smiths in the army they get numbered. And it's like, "So you're Smith number 70, and he just keeps saying, "You can't work this machine gun, Charlie. It's a bit technical. Evan's a bit technical. It's a bit technical." He's like one of your characters. Probably, you know what I mean? And then there's the fantastic Sergeant Old Bill Tozer with his tattoo of Britannia poking the Hun up the arse with their trident, and when he flexes his muscles, the trident goes into the arse of the Hun, and he hops in there. So there is that sort of humour in there. I just think that the fact that this is aimed at sort of 8- and 9-year-olds shows that, you know, that's the best way to tell a story. You know, because kids will not take any bullshit. That, you know, you can't go off on your sort of, you know, your little diversions or your artistic grace notes. You've got to get in, develop the characters and tell a story. You know, I my nephews had this force fed on them, and they became completely addicted to it, and they absolutely love it. So do you think your lad might be interested?
He might be. He does like Marvel. Andrew mentioned Marvel. He's a big Marvel fan. We've seen most Marvel films ever made now. They're getting a bit tedious, but he still likes them. I think he might like them. I like the fact that the trench was called the Ritz. You know, that bit of humour that was coming out of it. He might get those sorts of bits. I don't know. I don't want to shove Ward down his face because he's obsessed with North Korea and talks about Kim Jong-un and draws him all the time. That's
really
my son. Yeah, he's really obsessed. I don't really want to push him towards that, but maybe he's gravitating towards it already.
I mean, the war comics of the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s, people of, like, our age, it's kind of shaped our psyche in a lot of ways, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the psyche of
Andy
Britain.
Hawk, Ashton.
Yeah. Fine Hunt, all that kind of carry on. You know, much as we love them, do you think this produced the Brexit mindset, you know? Britain on basically the title sequence of Dad's Army as your map of politics?
Didn't work on me.
That didn't work on me either.
No, so, you know, that's, I mean, the room, I would say that it didn't necessarily work and turn us all into Brexiteers.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, we look back fondly on some
of
the things.
Struggled
to find
a Brexiteer in Soho.
We're not in massive. We're not drowning
in cappuccinos.
That sounds like a Chas and Dave song, doesn't it?
Yeah, the only Brexiteer. I'm the only Brexiteer in Soho.
Treating cappuccino like Tony Hancock did.
Yeah, no froth.
I want to drink it. I don't want to wash my socks in it.
It is a shame that the Weekly Comic has disappeared from the shelves, though, isn't it?
Because it's a massive shame.
Because it just not just that it got kids reading, but it introduces you to the beauty of illustration and illustrated.
Well, a lot of people have been saying they enjoy the fact that Versace is only on once a week and they have to wait for it.
Instead of on iPad.
Yeah, people are enjoying that again.
Yeah, the cliffhanger is a much neglected thing.
Except not during a three-part Agatha Christie, where you can't remember who all the suspects were from the week before.
Well, perhaps
you need that on over three consecutive nights, but I know they had their troubles.
Perhaps we can move on to that a little bit later. I think Charlie's War ought to be on the national curriculum myself.
Yes, so do
I. So we encourage you to read it. Charlie's War, Volume 1 for the Treasury of British Comics, and 2 and 3 are out, I think, at the same time, actually.
And it fostered my desire to become a cartoonist, which is what I wanted to do when I was a kid, because I read so many comics, including Wisdom Chips and the others. All of them made me want to be a cartoonist, which, even though I didn't become one full-time, probably led me into the part of the media that I managed to squeeze my way into.
I kept trying to make you do cartoons for Select, and you said, I'm not bloody doing them. Who did you imitate?
I imitated Robert Nixon, who drew Kid Kong and Frankenstein. For IPC Comics. Mm. Yeah, I loved him. I knew all that because they used to sign. Occasionally you'd find the signature of the cartoonist.
Yeah.
Now, unlike the more grown-up comics where they would tell you the name at the top, you'd have to find them.
That's
so when I found R.T. Nixon, I thought that was clever. R.T. Nixon.
Uh-huh.
I imagine they're all dead now. Yeah. I don't mean to say that cruelly, but I imagine they're all dead.
We'll not see their like again.
Yeah. Mm. Finally, Juliana Hatfield and her Olivia Newton-John covers album. Because she did some market research and everyone wants to see
Why not?
I mean, it's a bit... It is an odd one. The indie pop punk queen and the idol of soft focus 70s pop. But Juliana Hatfield is 100% sincere on this one. It bothers me when people write Olivia Newton-John off as a cupcake, she says. She had depth and breadth. What do we think? Do we agree? Let's have a listen to the Hatfield version of A Little More Love.
I hope she's going to sing in the voice that you just did there, Sean. It was a very good Juliana Hatfield voice. Here we go.
Thanks.
A Little More Love from Juliana Hatfield sings Olivia Newton-John. Andrew Collins, what are your memories of Juliana Hatfield, firstly?
Ah, Juliana Hatfield, yeah. We'll go back to Olivia Newton-John after we've done Juliana Hatfield.
Nice.
Well, she coincided with my time at the NME and grunge and post-grunge. So,
the shorts period.
Yeah, she was very useful because she was what's known as a female. And she was pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, I she was in the Lemonheads, and there was a bit of a sort of feeling that she was the person who, you know, was lucky enough to be in the Lemonheads with Evan Dando. But she played bass on it, sang vocals, backing vocals on it. So she was all over It's a Shame About Ray. So she was a celebrity at the time, and a good thing, because there were a lot of blokey bands about, you know, moaning about having to clear out their bedroom and stuff. So she was a refreshing breath of fresh air.
A refreshing breath of fresh air, yes.
Yeah, as were Belly and various others. So it was a kind of good time because it seemed quite sort of old, you know, teenage boy sort of music. So I liked her very much, and interviewed Evan Dando at the time in whatever her flat he was currently bedding down in, sofa surfing in, and we did a Mrs. Robinson photo session with a leg, and we needed a female leg, and he said I'll get a female who's prepared to put her leg up in front of me for the photograph, and he just got on the phone, and it was Tanya Donnelly.
Oh right.
So if we're having nostalgia about amazing women in grunge, Juliana Hatfield, very good. I didn't even know, I hadn't really taken much notice of her, but she's been going ever since. I don't think she's stopped making music. But yes, really, she really liked Olivia Newton-John.
She does. She what? You know, it was Olivia Newton-John part of your past?
Well, I mean, I remember seeing Loving Greece when that came out in 1978. So I would have been about 12, 13 at the time, and you know, came out of Greece thinking, I didn't know that it was set in the past. This is my thing. I thought that's what America was like. I mean, that's probably right. That probably was what America was like in 1978 as well as in the 1950s. I watched Happy Days, thought that was current, contemporary, hard-hitting realism. So I thought America was like that. So I got my view of what America was like, and I had no idea she was Australian.
Yeah.
Yeah, Happy Days just look like, you know, that must be what they all do. They go and have a milkshake at the Hop.
Yeah.
And Greece was that. So I saw her as an American. I had no idea she was Australian. Couldn't even tell from her speaking voice in the film. So it was a big shock to me to find out she was Australian.
Did you like this record?
Yeah, some bits of it are great. I mean, I like the songs anyway. Physical is a you know, you would think somebody doing Physical, you'd think they were sort of taking the piss.
Yeah.
But this is not. It's very sincere.
It is immensely sincere, yeah.
And the line in it that I wrote down, there's nothing left to talk about unless it's horizontally. It's quite saucy. It was definitely saucy.
It's enormously saucy,
But she was like a kind of Cliff Richard herself. She was a sort of a female Cliff Richard, wasn't she? Because she was a good girl
in
Sandra
Dee. Yeah.
So that sort of followed her around. And I noticed that they're giving a dollar for every one sold through the website of the record company. I'm sure it's a label rather than a company. They're giving a dollar to Olivia Newton-John's Cancer and Wellness Foundation, which is a rather nice touch.
That's
did you not think?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Simon, what did you make of it?
I've never been a fan of either. Grease, the film, it was a very big film, and all the boys fancied Olivia Newton-John, and all the girls went, yeah, but she's 48. They were sisters telling us how old she was, and we were like, it didn't really compute to me. But I remember my wife telling me that her aunts went to see Grease, and they loved it. And in those days, you could see the film twice. And they said we had 40 Bensons. We sat through and watched it twice.
Oh, wonderful.
That is a paradise, isn't it?
Yeah.
She's, I suppose, it's now, she now being viewed in an ironic way. I mean, in the old days, there was now irony in having these strange old 70s artists playing at Glastonbury on his theme. In the old days, they played Gay, didn't they? G-A-Y at the Astoria. And that they were then seen in a slightly ironic light. And I imagine she would be seen in that way, Olivia Newton-John.
Mm.
I mean, Physical has to be so bad it's good. It's not.
I just think it's good. I think it's good, good, good. Yeah.
I'm talking about her version, terrible video.
Yeah.
You like,
come on.
We don't agree on that. There's lush orchestration in the original stuff, and this is quite, she has taken it quite seriously, which is to be admired. I don't know enough about her stuff, though, to really comment on whether it's, whether she's, I've not really heard
anything that's going to happen. Yeah, it was like, au fait with
the canon. No,
sorry. Sean, what did you reckon?
Well, by the end of it, Juliana Hatfield doing Olivia Newton-John. I wanted Juliana Hatfield presents the songs of Ivor Cutler, or just someone. They had some sort of, you know, there's some difference, there's some light and shade. I found it really similar to the original. I read an interview where she says she's singing in the same key, to get that original feel. However, she can't sing that high, and there are bits where she's really straining, and you're hearing it, and it's weak and it's fragile, and is that meant to be a thing or is it not? And I wasn't really convinced. So I went back and I played Physical, and then I played the Olivia Newton-John version. And the Olivia Newton-John version is just amazing. And it actually really just walks all over poor Juliana Hatfield.
Yeah, that's why she sold 100 million records in her career, apparently.
Wow.
You know who I'm talking about, out of the two of them.
A suspiciously round number there.
That's massive, 100 million records. Yeah. That's pretty good.
And they sound fantastic.
Sold 250 million.
Yeah.
Sold albums. So I don't get that.
There's a lot of Nans around. Cliff was a huge pop star for ages.
I know he was.
Wired for sound. Come on.
As he said, the only true original pop star. He said that. I saw an interview with him years ago. He said, I've never done drugs. I came out Christian at the start. He said, all the others, they come out taking drugs and they get Christian at the end.
I invented rock and roll. That was all my idea. I believe that was the smash hits quote.
Oh, well.
Yes, I think he did invent it all.
Well done, Cliff. Well done.
Yeah.
I was surprised to like this record because I don't really like jangling, grungy, indie, schmindy stuff. But I thought that she dug out the raunch good and proper in this record. As a lot of it is very, very...
It's quite saucy, isn't it?
Saucy and hot under the collar. And it made me realise that how much, you know, sexy woman power is now the property of R&B and dance music. And it's kind of been bled out of rock. Particularly, you know, rock is sort of, you know, self-contemplating and narcissistic and a bit weedy and wet at the moment. And she's taken these sort of poppy disco songs and really dug out the kind of the straight out, you know, lust and filthiness that's inside them, and I was really impressed by that. Make a move on me, come on.
Did you know that, I only found this out yesterday, that physical was banned in two places in Utah, the original.
Yeah.
It's Too Saucy for Utah.
Too Saucy for Utah. Yeah. She should have called the album Too Saucy for Utah. Yeah.
My question is, why couldn't she have written original songs that were all saucy and indie and femo?
She
does
write original songs.
Why is she having
mostly
to do covers? I've got a theory. For this album, anyway.
Yeah. I've got a theory. And it is that in order to do that unadulterated lady lust, she has to inhabit another personality from another time.
That was my problem.
When that was the lingua franca of pop, when female pop stars were pumping sex machines, unlike now, where, that, like I say, that's the property of R&B, and sort of rock end of things has kind of become a bit bloodless. So I thought it was an interesting thing to do for that reason.
My theory was that pop that has eaten itself, and people can now only do impressions of something else. They can't be themselves because it's already been done. And she was becoming, the more I listened to it, the less I got.
Okay.
And I felt that, just rock out yourself, lady.
Well, I think she actually gets the sort of tragic, happy, sad thing that pop music does so well in this. It doesn't matter, Sean. We don't have to agree on everything.
We don't agree on this.
Don't have to agree on anything. No. And this brings us to the close of the 100th show. Hey. And that means closing time chatter. What are our guests going to discuss after the show over a white wine spritzer in the green room, a.k.a. a smelly alley off Great Windmill Street? Andrew Collins, what's your closing time chatter?
I don't want to give a spoiler, but I know that Simon is also interested to talk about TV drama. So let's talk about TV drama.
Yeah.
I am getting slightly weary of the very graphic violence which is now in TV drama. Now, you know, I've seen all the violent films there are. I've seen them all. It's not that I haven't seen them.
You're going to reinstitute the National Viewers and Listeners Association.
I feel a bit, stop the violence. Yeah. Because I didn't watch Marcella, the second series on ITV with Anna Friel, because I didn't really like the first one enough to watch the second one. But I saw some clips of it via Gogglebox, which is how I see a lot of things that I didn't watch. And they showed some clips from the end of what was obviously the final episode of the second series. And there was a boy in a school uniform, a little boy in a school uniform, strapped down in some grotty basement. And there was obviously a female baddie standing over him. She put little clips on his eyelids,
like
they do in
Clockwork
Orange.
Yeah.
Right? On the poor little actor. I know he's being paid, but nevertheless, he's in a school uniform and he's frightened to death. And then she gets this, what looks, I think it's like a knitting needle, and she's got it over his eye, right? Then Marcella comes in. This is a spoiler, but it's been on Gogglebox. She comes in, she comes in with a school girl who is the daughter of the mad serial killer woman. She's in her school uniform. Marcella gets out a Stanley knife, holds it to her throat and says, if you put that in his eye, I'm going to cut your daughter's throat. And I'm thinking, this is out of context. It is absolutely horrible. Why do writers of TV drama feel the need that they have to put dirty stuff in? I can't tell you anything about it, but I've been pitching a drama, TV drama. I really can't go into any more detail because it will jinx it. We wrote one script, the first episode, and we were told by one channel that there wasn't enough darkness in it, right? And so this is, I'm afraid, the trend in television, which is to outgross each other, which is a shame because, good drama doesn't need violence.
Yeah. And nothing has, not everything has to be HBO.
No, I agree. It's the HBO effect that's kind of, and this is ITV. Marcella, it's mainstream television. It's after 9 o'clock, but it's on mainstream television.
ITV have always been a bit techy, haven't they?
Yeah, but I just think they're going too far because if you've got a schoolboy with his eyelids held open and a knitting needle about to go in his eye, then the next one's going to have to be something worse than that.
So otherwise, Lars von Trier does Coronation Street.
It reminded me of von Trier, I must admit.
Mr. Day's never asked to do that because they came towards me with some things that opened my eyes. I'll be saying no thanks.
Yeah. But we were just about to offer you the musical of Clockwork Orange. Stop the Clockwork Orange, I want to get off. I remember when the height of independent television drama was Ari and Ralph's No was getting stolen on Brookside. That was true jeopardy.
That was a bad time, wasn't it? I was really worried for them.
They were having a really hard
the
time.
The stakes are being raised all the time. I'm not sure it's taken us in a good direction because, it was the crushing of skulls that started to happen, mostly on HBO. And you'd see it in films as well, where instead of shooting somebody, even shooting them in the face, you had to bash them with something hard and bash them and bash them and bash them, and you see the shot of the blood coming up on the person who's doing it. And then you'll see a brilliant bit of prosthetics, which is a bashed-in skull, and you have to see it.
You have people sitting around trying to come up with weird, odd deaths.
Yes, that's true. But we still don't have to see it.
And
it was horrible enough thinking about
where the old people saying, "What about the young people seeing the terrible violence? It's going to drive them mad, isn't it?" Well, I agree because I think it worse than that, it gets boring.
But I suppose that's all it is, really. And I sit watching television, my hand up between me and the screen, so I can't quite see it. Mm. Just like you do if you're watching, I don't know, a vet programme where they're showing an operation on a dog. You don't want to see that either, but that's real, and that will make the dog better. But this is not making anyone better.
Yeah. Simon Day, what's your closing
thought? I will follow on Andrew's theme about violence in drama and say the and particularly I watched the Agatha Christie Ordeal by Innocence. Mm. The constant tricky camera shots and palettes and different colorizations of the screen, and they're just constantly, you know, people being speeded up. I'm sick of people being speeded up. You watch a daytime TV show, a consumer program about someone who gas bills going up, and they have pictures of people walking in slow motion into the gas place. It's like, you know, they use every single thing. The first 20 minutes of this drama, they had the shot where Bill Nye stands there and all the Sunni rushes behind him. As my son said, where's he going? I said, no, it's an effect. You know, palettes is green, it's silvery grey, and then it's green, and then they shoot from underneath something and down there. And it's a spooky story anyway, and you can do all that. You know, you look at a film like Don't Look Now, you can make things scary and odd and strange. You don't have to constantly bash you over the head with all these effects. And it's similar to the violence thing. It's they're paranoid when no one's going to watch it. We've got to make it really so everyone's going to watch it. If we have just a man talking, it's not enough.
A few shows ago, we did Unsane, the Steven Soderbergh movie, which is shot on an iPhone, and the shots are all static. And and it's quite brown and grey, and very little kind of interference in the straight-up stuff that you see. And it scared the living shit out of me, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But genuinely well done, because focus on the character
it's
and the story.
It's not relying on the crutch of the effect.
Yeah, there's no tilt shift. There's no kind of like sudden... There's no like, oh, let's pinch the dolly shot from Jaws while someone's in a chip shop kind of thing.
Have you noticed that all films are coloured green as well?
Yeah, there's lots of greens in this.
There's so much green.
That's the Scandi influence,
off.
I think.
Yeah.
I think it is. Everything has to look like it could potentially be shot in Copenhagen.
So I thought all these colour palettes and craziness works really well on City in the City, because it's supposed to be psychedelic. It's supposed to be... You're not sure which city you're in or which place you're in.
Right.
It's all about the inside of your
head. You're right, because that is it's a stylish bit of shooting. The decision had been made to make it look in a certain way. There's a lot of stuff out of focus, but it follows through. It means something. Because as you say, it's about can you see the thing over there or not? Are you not supposed to look? Mm. And so it's actually justified thus far. Not awfully violent either. Not graphically violent.
I agree with Simon. Stop doing this to Holby City. That's what I say. Yes. Stop doing it to normal things.
Those consumer programmes in slow motion.
Not stop people walking in slow motion for no reason. Which I believe started with Scorsese.
Or it was resurrected by Quentin Tarantino, wasn't it? Because people walking in slow motion towards the washing machine showroom while do is kind of...
I'm wondering if it's in Battleship Potemkin, but I think they're all normal speed, aren't they?
Yeah. There's silent movie speed, which is slightly different, where people walk quickly. But aren't supposed
they walk really quickly, don't they? Get people walking really quickly again.
Absolutely.
That's the new move.
There you go. Yeah. Sean, what's your closing time,
Well, on a different note... Hacienda Classical. I was walking on Hampstead Heath yesterday. Kenwood House. Here's where we see sort of frothy people and Michael Bublé, who I know I love. Hacienda Classical at Kenwood House. Kenwood House
you're
being
joking.
The thing. Yeah.
The grimace on Simon right now is a picture. I wish we could. We were on the telly.
What, the Factory Records?
Yeah.
Those tracks.
In classical music form with Mike Pickering.
Like K-Class?
Yeah. Voodoo Ray, Pacific State, all done with some nice violins to some posh people who pay a lot of money for champagne in a hamper with a sandwich in it.
And
you
so
just
bad.
Exactly. I can't say any more, but that just made me feel sorrow for the human race, and it will last for another week.
It
makes me feel
prices,
really sad.
The prices that's really,
it's
really
like
bothering.
It's the milk thing, isn't it?
It's
rave,
the milking
rave
it.
Classics.
Yeah.
But it's the implication that things aren't really proper unless you've done them with an orchestra. The Albert Hall is really...
Let's make money out of every single format we can do with exactly the same
what
song.
What was the first rock classic album called? Classic, was it called?
Classic Rock. Hooked on Classics? No,
it was Hooked on Classics, wasn't it?
What Sky.
It had Wider Shade of Pale and Nights in White Satin on it. Yeah. Anyway, that was,
some
it
of those
was a massive
good.
Hit at the time when I was a kid. And I liked it at the time, but it was original then.
My closing time chatter, it's my new favourite website, EU versus Disinformation, which is a resource from the EU that calmly and forensically goes through fake news and shows you why it's fake. Like this week, they had a clip that had been circulated across social media from Russian television news about the chemical warfare attack in Duma, saying, well, these children might be sleeping, No, they're not bloody sleeping. They've been poisoned. Well, EU Disinformation versus Disinformation is an EU-funded organisation that goes through all this fake news,
good.
Pulls it to pieces, and it's really, really good. So the next time you're on social media and somebody's going, yeah, but do we really know that if Salisbury is really a city or was it just a set that the government built so it didn't yes. lose Dagenham and Redbridge in the by-election, go to EU versus Disinformation and post it on your nutty uncle's timeline.
And hopefully Chaz and Dave are running it because I still think they're the bastion of real news. And
the best
real
of real
life.
News.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
real
Public London. Enemy.
There ain't no fooling them, that's a fact.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. If Public Enemy was CNN for black people in America when there was no CNN, yeah. Chaz and Dave for the CNN for the displaced cockneys yeah. of now.
Yeah.
There we go. All right. Well, I'm sure we could stand that one up if we tried. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you to our guests for coming in for our 100th birthday show, Simon Day.
Honoured.
Been lovely to have you on. So remind us again what's happening with this the tour and the John Cooper Clarke one as well. What's
10th, 11th, 12th, Jackson's Lane, Highgate. I'm doing my solo show with four characters, and then later in the year, November, December, I'm supporting John Cooper Clarke. He'll sell loads of tickets anyway, so you haven't got to worry about it. Just go online and look at those. But my one, yeah, that's the one you need to come and see.
Is that going to be the character show, or is it going to be a different show? With
no,
the
same character show.
Okay.
With John Cooper Clarke, I just do Jeffrey Allison.
Mm-hmm.
I just do 20 minutes.
Okay, excellent. Andrew Collins, thank you very much for coming in. What are you up to next?
Pleasure. Still touting around the drama I can't talk about. Mm-hmm. And I will be going back to Radio Times this afternoon to decide what the films of the day will be for the days and the week. Next week's magazine.
Do people still keep the Radio Times under Dad's chair, under the cushion?
Do you know what they do? They get in touch if they think that something you've said isn't factually correct, and sometimes, occasionally, it isn't, and you write back to them personally, and it's a very nice relationship we have with our readers.
There you go.
Yeah, they're good.
That's what we want. Print is proper. So, thank you for listening. Thank you, as ever, to my irreplaceable co-pilot, Sean, and to producer, Jack Clarimont. Remember, you can hear all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. And if you want to support the show with a few quid, you can buy us that invisible virtual pint via patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast. 100 shows down, and we didn't think it too many. See you all next week.